This is Professor Richard Carlson, and this is the lecture originally scheduled for October 23rd. We'll begin with our usual review in slide one. Last week we discussed the employer's continuing duty to bargain, either about any changes it intends to make during the term of an existing agreement, or about any new topics the union might like to address during the term of the agreement. In general, the employer does have a duty to bargain before making any changes that would not otherwise be prohibited by the agreement, or about any proposals that the union might raise about things it didn't discuss in the earlier negotiations. The Act does relieve the employer of its duty to bargain about things contained in the agreement. Thus, if the agreement explicitly addresses the topic, the employer has no further duty to bargain during the term of the agreement. If the parties actually discussed a proposal and the agreement omits that proposal, that is an implicit rejection, and we regard that as an item contained in the agreement. There's no duty to bargain. The union, for example, can't continue to raise this even after it lost the issue in the initial negotiations. The continuing duty to bargain then relates mainly to things that are not written into the agreement, not addressed in the agreement, and that were not discussed in the earlier negotiations leading to that agreement. Now, the actual contours of that duty are likely to be determined by the terms of the contract. For example, a zipper clause might waive the union's right to raise new topics, and it might even waive the union's right to demand bargaining about changes the employer would like to make that do not otherwise violate the agreement. The employer also will likely have demanded a broad no-strike clause that would prohibit the union from striking as a matter of objecting to changes the employer wishes to make, again, provided these changes don't violate the collective bargaining agreement. And finally, the union response to all of this is likely to be a so-called maintenance of standards clause, which prohibits the employer from making any changes during the term of the agreement if those changes would diminish the terms and conditions of the employees. Therefore, for an example, the employer could decide to give out some new Christmas bonus that's not addressed in the agreement. It's not prohibited by the agreement. Suppose the parties never talked about it before, therefore this subject is not to be regarded as contained in the agreement. The employer can make this change. Most likely the union will have waived its right to negotiate in their zipper clause. It's not a violation of the maintenance of standards clause because this increases benefits for employees rather than diminishing them. So let's go on now to where we left off last week, which is the rules governing the parties' economic warfare. We talked about the various weapons that the parties can use, and when we left off, we were discussing the Elk Lumber case. So let's go to our second slide, strike and employer response. This is the case where the employees have engaged in not a full strike, but something called a slowdown, and the question is whether or not the employer can discipline and discharge employees who participated in the slowdown. The answer is yes. The employees were engaged in concerted activity, but their action still constituted cause for the employer to discharge. Let's go to slide three now, which talks about the problem of the so-called partial strike and the potentially unprotected status of such activity. The court decided that this partial strike, this slowdown, was a cause for discharge because of the inconsistency of collecting pay but not really working. That's wrong, whether it's done individually or as a group. Compare, in contrast, a full-fledged strike. No one can compel you to go to work. Striking is your typical way as a player in the economic world of withholding your goods or services as part of your demand for greater pay. And not working and not being paid for it is not inconsistent. We might also consider an unspoken or silent factor that may in fact be affecting the way the court and the board look at these issues. That silent factor or concern is the balance of power. What would be the effect of protecting such warfare? Can we imagine a world in which employees, in support of their demands, go to work but sit on their hands all day long and do nothing, and yet they are entitled to be paid because the employer is not entitled to discharge them? That would certainly empower the unions, but to such a great extent that employers would be completely at their mercy. In fact, if unions could engage in this sort of conduct, it's difficult to see exactly what would be the limits of their demand. The only limits would be the employer's failure as a business, and that seems too extreme an outcome and too one-sided a balance of power. Let's take a look now at a chart in slide number 4 showing the lawfulness of various employee weapons, some of the rules and possible factors that affect the way the board and the courts look at these problems. By the way, when we talk about employee weapons, remember that the strike is just one example. We also have a variety of partial strikes and picketing that we've talked about before, and we're going to see more examples in just a moment. So what are some of the limiting rules and factors? Well, first of all, conduct that's illegal by an individual is still illegal even if it's done in concert. You can't get away with it just by demanding or working with a second person. Number two, if it's illegal or wrongful, it's not protected, and as a result, the employer can discharge. So action that you take that is disrespectful, tortious, a breach of your contract or of your duties as an employee is still wrongful, even though you've done it in concert. Third, let me point out that employee tortfeasors, people, for example, who damage property, or the union itself, might be civilly or even criminally liable for engaging in this sort of conduct. And finally, in red, I put that silent factor. It's a factor that the courts and the board frequently deny that they're considering, but you have to imagine that it's in the back of their minds. The effect of this behavior on the balance of power if we were to grant protection to it. Now, let's go to the other side of the chart. Rules that expand, or factors that expand the protection for employees. First of all, remember that to the extent we're talking about speech, communicative behavior by employees or the union, picket signs, for example, this behavior is likely to have at least some protection, not only by Section 7, but also by the First Amendment. Secondly, frequently these cases will involve a mixture of motives. It's true that an employee misbehaved. And by the way, misbehavior tends to be the rule rather than the exception on the picket line, certainly on civil behavior. People do and say things that, were they to do this in the office or on the work floor, would be grounds for discharge. But we have to remember that it's not enough to say that the conduct was unprotected. The fact that the employees were engaged in pro-union concerted activity means that there's a real likelihood that the employer was motivated to discriminate. That means to say that the employer has a special discriminatory intent, or the potential for one, and therefore we have to regard these as potential mixed motive cases. Thus, for example, even though it's not protected to commit a trespass, to be, for example, on the employer's property when the employer has denied you permission to be there, is it grounds for discharge if the employee puts his toe on the employer's property as he's picketing, just, for example, to annoy the employer? The answer is that we have to address this as a mixed motive case. Do we think that the employer would discharge an employee who's clocked out if the employee suddenly puts his toe on the employer's property? And the answer is, this is very unlikely. On the other hand, there's going to be some kinds of picket line activity or partial strike activity that really could be grounds for discharge. We can believe that the employer would discharge the employee for this sort of thing, irrespective of the employee's involvement in strike, union, or organizational activity. Now, remember that the employer is going to bear the burden of persuasion regarding cause in any disciplinary case, and that's important when you remember that this is a mixed motive case, because before the employer disciplines or discharges the employee, you have to think about whether you're going to be able to bear that burden of persuasion. Final bullet on the right-hand side of this slide. The NLRB has a tendency, particularly during pro-labor boards, to forgive employee action in the heat of the labor. I call it labor's passion. It's the excitement that's going on in organizational activity, particularly strike and picket line activity. Emotions are hot. People are excited. They tend to forget the usual rules of civility. And the board, in its fact-finding phase, at least the administrative law judges who are deciding this case, may tend to err in favor of the employee in these hotly contested cases. Now, I want to call your attention to the blueprint at the bottom of the slide, which is an overriding concern that you're not going to read about in the cases or the law books, and that's the practical concern here. Employers can't always fire employees, even when they have cause to do so, and even when the employee is unprotected. And that's because the union also has some power here, or it might have some power. Remember, unions can continue the strike, or they can call a strike that they might not have called before. They can continue to drag out negotiations and make life difficult for the employer. And the employer also, therefore, must consider before he discharges employees, how will this affect my relationship with the union? Maybe the employer doesn't care. In many cases, the employer is actually only too happy to make relations with the union only worse. And therefore, this factor may or may not affect the employer's ultimate decision. We can also imagine that in the conclusion of a strike, frequently there will be some further negotiation between the union and the employer. And what I mean by that is that to finally settle the strike and get employees back to work, the union might demand at least some concessions in the way we handle returning strikers individually or collectively. Let's move on to slide number 5 now, which is a test case for our rules and factors. Let's imagine a sit-down strike. Now, sit-down strikes were once very popular among workers. There are reasons why unions have to be very careful about this, because a sit-down strike has not been regarded as protected. Now, the goal of a sit-down strike is to combine a full strike with a action to prevent the business operations from continuing. Remember that a strike is a test of endurance. The employees are going without pay, so to beat the employer, their goal is to prevent the employer from earning profits and doing business. It can do that perhaps by occupying the workplace and preventing any work from being done. Now, a sit-down action is a trespass, and a trespass is a trespass even if it's done in concert. It's also therefore a tort. There might be criminal liability and there might be civil liability for the actors, both individually and the union. And remember that the employer would be only too happy to be in a position to sue the union and collect monetary damages from the union for its sit-in action. And damages in a case like this, which will be based on lost profits, could be quite substantial. Well, since a trespass is tortious and potentially criminal, it is not protected from employer discipline or discharge. So it turns out that the civil liability and criminal liability are not all the employees have to worry about. They could also be fired. Now, because of what I've already said, this is actually a pretty easy case. Let me just add in some balance of power concerns here. If it were necessary to go that far, if unions could occupy the employer's plant, again, this may or may not tip the balance of power too far. Some people might argue, in fact, union supporters have in fact argued, that to allow the union to occupy the facility really balances power between the parties, because both the union and the employer are going to be losing income during this period of time. If the employees have to suffer loss of income, then perhaps the employer should also. But thus far, the board and the courts haven't seen it that way. We might also raise the mixed motive problem. Is it possible that the union or the employee could argue, you wouldn't ordinarily have fired me for this kind of trespass if I hadn't been on strike? And I think the answer to that question is usually going to be pretty easy. If instead of going home at the end of my lecture, I barge into someone else's class and make a scene, or otherwise occupy the front of the classroom in an effort to prevent other people from teaching, that would be grounds for discharge, whether or not I was on strike or a member of the union. And finally, we might add that there's no particular reason to forgive the employees for their exuberance or their passion in a sit-down strike, because the truth is that a sit-down strike requires a lot of planning. This is not a heat of passion kind of moment. So sit-down strikes are therefore unprotected. Let's move on to slide number 6, which is other concerted actions to support bargaining demands. Again, the typical goal of any of these actions is to maximize the interference with the employer's business at a minimum cost to the employees or the union. In other words, the employees don't want to lose their wages, but they want to interfere with the employer's business. One example would be the so-called blue flu. The blue flu comes from a practice of police officers who, in every state that I'm aware of, are prohibited from going on strike. So what do police officers do when they are upset about the progress of negotiations with a city? And the answer is they call in sick, hence the name Blue Flu. Now, I understand that there's been a controversy whether pilots of American Airlines have been engaged in this kind of tactic by calling in sick, even though they aren't. It's a way of perhaps engaging in a strike, but not really being engaged in a strike. Note that under many workplace rules, by the way, the people who call in strike are still earning their pay under any applicable sick leave plan. Now, this is a kind of misrepresentation. You would be treated a certain way, I suppose, if you had a sick leave plan and you called in alleging to be sick, even though you are really going to Disneyland and you'd already used up your vacation time and pay, but you wanted to use your sick leave time to extend your vacation. I've certainly known employers to fire people for doing this sort of thing. So we can imagine that the employer might be able to prove cause for discharge if it can prove that a particular individual wasn't really sick at the time they called in with their alleged flu. Proving this, by the way, when you have 1,000 people doing it all at one time might seem easy, but on a case-by-case and individualized basis, it can actually be quite difficult. Some other possible labor actions that may or may not be protected. Let's talk about intermittent strikes. also known as hit-and-run strikes. Suppose I, as a law professor, decide that I want to maximize the impact of my strike activity without losing too much pay. As you may know, the most important part of my job is teaching class. Even though in theory I have a full-time job, I could say the only time that I'm going to be on strike is at 12:20 until 1:50. In other words, during our class time. Now, that strike time would not be a huge hit on my pay if we calculated my loss on an hourly rated basis. On the other hand, it would be the complete prevention of the employer's business. Thus, intermittent strikes are generally regarded as unprotected. Now, it's a situation like this that I think really takes us to the factor of balance of power, because if a strike is in general protected, why should we say that striking for just an hour at a time is unprotected? And the only reason that really persuades me in this regard, by the way, is that to allow intermittent strikes would add too much power to the union. Again, the cost to the employees could be minimal, but it could be extreme to the employer to such an extent that the employer in many instances would be completely at the mercy of the union. Moving on down the list, let's talk about so-called intermittent strikes, or rolling strikes, where we have various departments of employees and only one department strikes at a time. Imagine an assembly line where different departments work on different parts of the automobile as it's moving down the assembly line. We can minimize the impact on the employees by striking in groups only one at a time, so that, for example, I only lose a day's worth of pay, but there are five other departments, and they each take their own turn striking just for one day. But by striking in this manner, we can shut down the employer's business for an entire week because he needs all five departments to be working at the same time to make his assembly work. Again, the board and court's view has been that so-called rolling strikes are too destructive and therefore not protected. Moving on down the list, striking some tasks but not others. Here's an example that you might appreciate. There's a case involving teaching assistants at a university who had formed a union. They decided to go on strike, but again, they didn't want to go on a complete strike, so they struck only with respect to one particular task. Can you imagine what that task was? Well, it was grading exams. Now, naturally, this means that the poor professor has got to grade his own exams in those places that have teaching assistants who do that sort of thing. We don't, by the way. But the board regarded this as a partial strike. Again, it was as if the teaching assistants were working and drawing their pay, but not really working after all, particularly considering the importance of the grading function. Moving on down the list, I have one devoted to true spontaneous strikes by non-union employees. Putting everything we've said thus far aside, I want you to imagine a scenario that used to happen a lot, still happens occasionally. Something really horrible happens at the workplace. Suppose you have a restaurant in which the manager has been engaging in severe sexual harassment. Finally, he harasses one of the waitresses, and this is the straw that broke the camel's back. That waitress and all of the other waitresses suddenly walk out immediately in spontaneous reaction to this manager's horrible behavior. This is the kind of spontaneous job action that was once more common than it is today. Do we regard this as, for example, an intermittent hit-and-run strike? What happens if they come back the next day? Do we regard it as a partial strike? In general, the The board has tended to treat these kinds of spontaneous actions, particularly by employees who lack the support of an outside union, as being protected. We give them a little bit more leeway. We may have seen an example of this in the Washington aluminum case, in which employees stopped working on the spot because it was too cold. These spontaneous strikes in these circumstances simply tend to get more protection. Next on our list, work cruel action or other actions designed to slow down operations. Now, a work to ruin operation is where the employees try to hurt their employers by doing exactly, and I underline exactly, what they are supposed to do. Now, there's a difference between what you're supposed to do and what you're supposed to do in the real working world. And let me give you an example of how that has played out recently for the airline pilots at American Airlines. And again, I'm just reporting to you the media accounts. I don't really know what's going on there. It is alleged that some pilots are interfering with the normal schedule by exercising their duties to inspect the aircraft with great diligence. As you may or may not know, the airline captain, the pilot, has a duty and a right to inspect the aircraft and to make sure that it is in tip-top shape before we fly off. You would want that kind of responsibility in the pilot, but a pilot obviously can take that too far. He can perhaps refuse to fly because one section of the carpet isn't properly cleaned. Now, if you take this to an extreme, the employee's argument is, well, I'm just doing what I'm supposed to do. And in fact, I have even a right not to fly if the plane isn't really ready to go. But you can also imagine that this can be done specifically to interfere with the employer's business. I'll give you another example of work to rule actions. Police officers who are upset about the course of negotiations have been known to target certain neighborhoods for writing tickets. Typically, they target the neighborhoods of very powerful people. They'll go out and monitor every street in that neighborhood, and they'll give a ticket to anybody who drives even 1 mile per hour over the speed limit. They'll do that without losing any pay, the purpose being to upset people in the city management and to bring pressure against them to negotiate better with the union. Now, the usual answer of the board and the courts in cases subject to the board's jurisdiction is that a work to rule action, if we can prove that it's unreasonable and if it's really designed to hurt the employer, is not really protected, which means, again, provided we can prove it, the employee is subject to discharge. And the last bullet on this particular slide, wildcat strikes. You've probably heard of the term wildcat strike before. People use it to mean a lot of different things. To my mind, what it means is any strike that is either in violation of the collective bargaining agreement's no strike clause or is unauthorized by the union and may have the effect of actually undermining the union's effort to negotiate. So you can imagine some subset of employees who are not only upset with the course of negotiations, they don't think the union's doing its job on a particular issue that's important to them. And therefore, they engage in their own strike. The board has tended to withhold protection for employees who engage in such wildcat actions. Let's move on to slide number 7 now, where I talk about the heat of passion problem that occurs on the picket line. We're imagining a situation in which the union has conducted a proper, complete strike. The employees really are losing pay. They have not only withheld their services, but they are suffering the full loss of the paycheck. And they're trying to enforce the strike by the usual picket line. Now, the danger of picket line has always been that this is a very emotional place, emotional activities going on. The strikers are trying to prevent other people from crossing that line And they're going to do that either by embarrassing, insulting, or intimidating the employees. Now, it may be that the union has actually instructed or encouraged picketers to engage in extra acts of intimidation, but whether or not the union has actually encouraged this or authorized this, you can imagine that individual picketers who see a threat to their own jobs may take matters into their own hands. They may say things that the union would not have authorized. They may do things that the union would not have authorized. And that's why the picket line can tend to be a dangerous place for all of the parties. In a situation like this, it's not just the picketers who might be acting in the heat of passion. The replacements themselves might be provoked. The employer in these situations may hire private security. In the old days, this would mean hiring basically gang members who would sometimes fight with the picketers. These days, we mean presumably licensed security guards who are there to maintain the peace. But again, these are private security guards, not always very well trained, and sometimes not always doing their job in the right way. So, what are the rules that apply to the picket line that might have effect on things that are said or done there? Let's remember, number one, that in terms of civil or criminal liability for things said or done on the picket line, we have the First Amendment, which protects free speech. As for whether the employer can discharge employees, whether they are protected under Section 7, that's another matter. Things that might be protected under the First Amendment might still exceed the limits of what employees have a protected right to do insofar as their relations with the employer. And finally, let's remember the cautionary note that I gave you at the very outset. The board tends to give extra leeway for this heat of passion moment when people are expected to get excited and to say things they wouldn't ordinarily have said. And this will be particularly true if the employee can argue, well, I was provoked in some fashion to engage in this kind of behavior. Let's advance now to slide number 8, and we're going to talk about one kind of problem that we see on the picket line, and that's the threat of violence or the threat of other tortious behavior. And this is an area that has really been difficult for the board because, as I've suggested before, we have vacillation between Republican and Democratic administrations. Over time, these differences have tended to narrow, and I'm going to spare you a lot of history by talking about what continues to be the prevailing rule in before the NLRB today. It's the Universal Trust case, which was decided in 2006. You may remember that would have been under the Bush administration, but thus far the Obama administration hasn't done anything to change this particular rule, so we can regard it as the rule that remains in effect. In this case, you had an employer who discharged a couple of employees for threatening conduct during a strike. This happened in the course of a picket line confrontation between strikers and replacements. It was what I would have described as one of those heat of passion moments because from the striker's point of view, their jobs are being threatened. On the other hand, you can imagine the feelings of the replacements who are perhaps threatened in their lives or their property. Now, NLRB's general rule is that exuberant concerted activity not directly threatening physical harm is still protected. What do we mean by exuberant concerted activity? Well, I suppose we mean the kind of behavior that you wouldn't ordinarily engage in at the workplace. Using loud words, profanity, name calling, making faces at people, making gestures at people, giving them the finger, if you'll excuse the expression. These are things that we don't ordinarily do, and they might even get us fired if we did that at the workplace. You can think of this as the sort of exuberant concerted activity that does not directly threaten physical harm. And in general, employees are allowed to do this. Not only is it not criminally or civilly liable, but it's also protected from the employer's disciplinary action. But the rule indicates an important limit. We cannot directly threaten physical harm. Now, this is going to, in fact, require some very difficult interpretation and line drawing. And I give you the two separate incidents in the Universal Trust case. You have one picketer who tells a replacement worker or calls to him, come outside if you're a man, don't lock yourself in like a whore. Now, if I heard that, if somebody said that to me, it would sound a lot like they were challenging me to a fight, and it might imply that if they ever got me outside the gate, they would challenge me to a fight, whether I liked it or not. And I could interpret that as threatening, but even under the Bush administration board, this doesn't pass the test of directly threatening physical harm. It's the sort of exuberance that happens on the picket line, and therefore the employer violated the law by discharging this employee. On the other hand, let's look at the second incident. An employee said, "We are going to get you all alone and blank you up. I'll let you fill in the blank." That comes close enough to a threat of direct physical harm that the employer lawfully discharged the employee. Now, there is a second line of authority that deals with the problem of employee profanity or other opprobrious conduct that doesn't actually violate or threaten harm, but it's still really ugly stuff. It's ugly stuff, the sort of stuff that you would be fired for, and the employer fire you for if it happens on the picket line. Now, I want to remember that these employees are not on duty, and in general, you can't be fired for things, or you, let me say, you could be fired, but the employer ordinarily would not fire you for stuff that you do in a bar or at a public park, not while on duty. Still, if you're doing this to coworkers or supervisors in a way that's going to create really bad relations and shows a really extreme level of disrespect, maybe this would be the sort of thing that the employer would fire you for. Let me point out at the outset that in these cases of other opprobrious conduct, we have to initially ask the question, can the employer prove it would have discharged this employee just for that opprobrious conduct, isolating it from the fact that this happened on a picket line and that you were doing this to enforce a picket line and to annoy the employer? Well, secondly, if we can hold that the employer can prove he would in fact have discharged you for this, are you nevertheless protected? And the board has never been able to come up with a very clear-cut test for this sort of problem. I'll give you here the Atlantic Steel Company four-part test of factors. Number one, where did it happen? For example, did it happen in front of a public audience? Or was it a private conversation that was not really overheard by other people? What was the subject matter of the conversation? Well, in other words, what words did you use and in what context? What was the nature of the employee outburst? And finally, was there any kind of provocation by the employer's unfair labor practices? And I might add, perhaps provocation by perhaps a supervisor's opprobrious conduct. And that's not a very easy rule to apply because it is so fact intensive, but it's all that we have at this point. Let's move on to slide number 10 for a few words about the union's potential civil liability for wrongful concerted action. You know, the employee has to worry about losing his job. The union, in some cases, could actually be sued if it authorized, encouraged, or organized wrongful conduct. Remember, some acts are tortious or criminal as well as unprotected. Imagine, for example, a sit-down strike organized by the union. You may also remember that the Norris LaGuardia Act says that unions can be liable and individual officers can be liable, but only upon clear proof of their actual participation, authorization, or ratification. Now, this means that the union will only be held liable and its officers will be held liable individually, only based on something like a clear and convincing standard of proof of their personal involvement. And that could be a difficult standard to prevail on. I think I recall vaguely a few years ago in which I believe it was the union that represented the airline pilots. They engaged in an unprotected strike action, and eventually the union was held liable for that, and a lot of dollars are at stake in a situation like that. Now, the Norris LaGuardia Act applies only to federal courts by its terms. It's an open question whether the states, if you sue in a state court, could apply a mere preponderance of the evidence standard. To make a long story short, almost 100 years after the enactment of the Norris LaGuardia Act, it's still unclear whether this law preempts the application of state rules of evidence. I'll tell you briefly that in Texas, there's very little case law on this, but the impression that I have is that state courts in general abide by the Norris LaGuardia Act's standard of proof. Now, I'm going to ask you to read the next slide, number 11, on your own, and that will introduce us to the next problem area. So put this on pause and then restart it again when you're ready to go on. I presume at this point that you are ready to proceed to slide number 12, which gives us a checklist for dealing with employees' publicity against their employer. Sometimes, in addition to striking, the employees will put insulting things about their employers on their picket signs, or they will say insulting things to the media. They may disparage the employer's business or its product. This might be seen as a kind of defamation, particularly where the employee's words attack the employer's business or its product. So, is it protected? For example, if I decided to go on strike, could I wander up and down San Jacinto Street with a picket sign saying that the school gives a lousy education? Now, here's the set of factors that we have to bear in mind when we think about this problem. Number one, was it part of a legitimate labor dispute? And in particular, was a strike going on? The rules are going to be different if I'm an employee who is part of an organized labor dispute against the employer, because now labor law is going to apply rather than just the regular routine state defamation law. Number two, were the employees hurting the employer while earning pay? The courts and the board have tended to look at this sort of thing a little bit like a partial strike, where the employees are trying to have it both ways. They are trying to earn money at the same time that they're trying to hurt their employer. And this means that there's already, we're leaning more in favor of denying protection for many of the same sorts of reasons we discussed when we talked about partial strikes. Secondly, we have to examine the employee's message very carefully, because maybe what the employees were saying is that we want you, the consumer, to support us by not buying the employer's product. That's not disparagement of a product, that's just asking the community's support for your side of the dispute. It's a different matter, however, if I say on my picket sign, "This school gives a lousy education." I'm not just asking you to stop supporting the school because you should support me in my labor dispute. I'm conveying some message that's going to hurt my employer long after the dispute is resolved. Number four, was the disparagement untruthful? If it was rank defamation, I'm much, much less likely to be protected. And in general, if it's an intentional or malicious disparagement, I'm not going to have any protection at all. You may remember, by the way, all of these issues came up not only on the picket line, but earlier we talked about this in connection with the Facebook cases. Our issues are really very much the same here. Number five, did my message reveal that it was perhaps provoked by a labor dispute? And this is to prevent the public from being misled. If my sign asks people not to do business with this institution, I should let the public know that this is my side of a labor dispute, so they can make their decision based on that important information. Now, these are all the factors that the board and the courts have worked their way through. I'm simply going to tell you that the cases are very hard to reconcile. You'll see some in which the employees win protection and others in which they lose their protection. I think you have to look at each case pretty much on its own facts. You have to look at who's actually sitting on the board. You have to look at the judges who are reviewing the case, and you have to get some sort of feeling about the atmosphere generally, politically, and socially at the time the case arises. All of this has to be considered. And it makes the outcome of these cases particularly unpredictable. My guess, by the way, is also this, that unrepresented employees, again, employees acting in spontaneous but truly concerted action, tend to get a little bit more sympathy than those, perhaps, who are organized by an outside union that should know better. Now, at this point, I'm not quite one-third of the way through the slide. I'm going to go ahead and put this on pause and save this portion of the lecture. Go ahead and try to get it uploaded to make sure that I can make all of this happen before I invest another 30 or 40 minutes in this lecture. So this is the conclusion of this part of the lecture.